books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we are listening to the six books on this year's shortlist for the Booker Prize. Plus, we'll get some book recommendations from last year's winner. RNIB is very proud to work with the Booker Prize Foundation to ensure shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are available in accessible formats for everyone to enjoy as close to the shortlist announcement as possible. All the books on the 2024 shortlist are now available in audio and also Braille. So today, let's go through them. And we'll get the books of your life from last year's winner, Paul Lynch. In no particular order, let's take a listen. Anne Michael's book, Held, is a narrative that spans four generations. Moments of connection and consequence ignite and reignite as the century unfolds. Anne's Booker Prize Foundation six-word description was only three.
Not still. Held.
1917. On a battlefield near the River Escaut, John lies in the aftermath of a blast, unable to move or feel his legs. Struggling to focus his thoughts, he is lost to memory. A chance encounter in a pub by a railway. A hot bath with his lover on a winter night. His childhood on a faraway coast, as the snow falls. Held by Anne Michaels is read by the author.
We know life is finite. Why should we believe death lasts forever? The shadow of a bird moved across the hill. He could not see the bird. Certain thoughts comforted him. Desire permeates everything. Nothing human can be cleansed of it. We can only think about the unknown in terms of the known. The speed of light cannot reference time. The past exists as a present moment. Perhaps the most important things we know cannot be proven. He did not believe that the mystery at the heart of things was amorphous or vague or a discrepancy, but a place in us for something absolutely precise. He did not believe in filling that space with religion or science, but in leaving it intact, like silence or speechlessness or duration. Perhaps death was Lagrangian, perhaps it could be defined by the principle of stationary action, asymptotic, mist smoldered like cremation fires in the rain. It was possible that the blast had taken his hearing. There were no trees to identify the wind, no wind, he thought, at all. Was it raining? John could see the air glistening, but he couldn't feel it on his face. The mist erased all it touched. Through the curtain of his breath, he saw a flash, a shout of light. It was very cold. Somewhere out there were his precious boots, his feet. He should get up and look for them. When had he eaten last? He was not hungry. Memory seeping. The snow fell, night and day, into the night again. Silent streets, impossible to drive. They decided they would walk to each other across the city and meet in the middle. The sky, even at 10 o'clock at night, was porcelain, a pale solid from which the snow detached and fell. The cold was cleansing, a benediction. They would each leave at the same time and keep to their route. They would keep walking until they found each other.
1920. John has returned from war to North Yorkshire, near another river, alive but not still whole. Reunited with Helena an artist, he reopens his photography business and endeavours to keep on living.
In the distance and the heavy snowfall, John saw fragments of her, elliptic, stroboscopic, Helena's dark hat, her gloves. It was hard yet to tell how far away she was. He shook the snow from his hat so she might see him too. Yes, she lifted her arms above her head to wave. Only her hat and gloves and the powdery yellow blur of the street lamps were visible against the whiteness of sky and earth. He could barely feel his feet or his fingers, but the rest of him was warm, almost hot from walking. He pulsed with the sight of her, the vestige of her. She was everything that mattered to him. He felt inviolable trust. They were close now, but could not make their way any faster. Somewhere between the library and the bank, they gripped each other as if they were the only two humans left in the world. Her small ways known only to him. That Helena matched her socks to her scarf even when no one could see them in her boots. That she kept beside the bed, superstitiously unfinished, the novel she'd been reading in the park the day they understood they would always be together. The paper-thin leather gloves she found in the pocket of the men's tweed coat she bought from the jumble sale. Her mother's ring that she wore only when she wore certain blouses. That she left her handbag at home and slipped a 5-shilling note in her book when she went to the park to read. The boiled sweets tin she kept her foreign change in.
The past erupts insistently into the present as ghosts begin to surface in his pictures. Ghosts whose messages he cannot understand. So begins a narrative that spans 4 generations. Moments of connection and consequence igniting and reigniting as the century unfolds.
Helena carried the handbag he had bought for her on the hill road, soft brown leather with a clasp in the shape of a flower. She wore the silk scarf she had found in the market, made hers now by her scent, autumn colors with a dark green border, and her tweed coat with velvet under the collar. How many times had he felt that velvet when he held open her coat for her? A finite number. Every pleasure in a day or a life numbered. But pleasure was also countless, beyond itself, because it remained even only in memory, and in your body, even when forgotten. Even the stain of pleasure in its taunting loss. The finite as unmanageable as the infinite. They walked to his flat and left their wet clothes at the door. No need to turn on the lights. The blinds were up, the room snow-lit. White dusk, impossible light. John was always surprised. He never stopped being astonished at how little there was of her. She was tiny, it seemed to him, and so gentle and fierce he couldn't breathe. He had bought the scented powder she liked and he filled the tub. He added too much and the foam spilled over the steaming edge. A snowbank, she said. The young soldier was lying only a few meters away. How long had the boy been staring? John wanted to call out to him, make a joke of it, but couldn't find his voice. Pinned to the ground, no weight upon him. Who would believe light could fell a man?
Ann Michaels reading her book, Held, available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
On today's Read On, we are listening to the 6 books on the Booker Prize shortlist ahead of the winner's announcement on Tuesday. And next up is The Safekeep by Yael van der Wolken is an exhilarating tale of twisted desire, histories and homes, and the legacy of one of the 20th century's greatest tragedies. Here's how she described the book for the Booker Prize Foundation in 6 words or less.
2 women, summer, homes, obsession and mystery. I think that's about six.
Almost six. It's 1961, and the rural Dutch province of Overijssel is quiet. Bomb craters have been filled, buildings reconstructed, and the war is well and truly over. Living alone in her late mother's country home, Isabel's life is as it should be, led by routine and discipline. But all is suspended when her brother Louis delivers his graceless new girlfriend Eva at Isabel's doorstep as a guest, there to stay for a reason. The audio version of The Safekeep is read by Saskia Marleveld and Stinta Nielsen.
Isabel found a broken piece of ceramic under the roots of a dead gourd. Spring had brought a shock of frost, a week of wet snow, and now at the lip of summer, the vegetable garden was shrinking into itself. The beans, the radishes, the cauliflower, browned and rotting. Isabel was on her knees, gloved hands and a stringed hat, removing the dying things. The shard nicked through her glove, pierced a little hole. It wasn't a wound and it didn't bleed. Isabel took off her glove and stretched the skin of her palm tight, looking for a puncture. There was none. Only a sting of pain that left quickly. Back at the house, she washed the piece and held it in watery hands. Blue flowers along the inch of a rim, the suggestion of a hare's leg where the crockery had broken. It had once been a plate, which was part of a set, her mother's favorite, the good chinaware, for holidays, for guests. When mother was alive, the set was kept in a glass vitrine in the dining room, and no one was allowed to handle it. It had been years since her passing, and the plates were still kept behind the closed doors, unused. On the rare occasion when Isabel's brothers visited, Isabel would set the table using everyday plates, and Hendrik would try to pry open the vitrine and say,
Isa, come now. What's the point of having good things if you can't touch them?
And Isabel would answer, they are not for touching. They are for keeping.
Eva is Isabel's antithesis. Sleeps late, wakes late, walks loudly through the house, and touches things she shouldn't. In response, Isabel develops a fury-filled obsession, and when things start disappearing around the house, a spoon, a knife, a bowl, Isabel's suspicions spiral out of control.
There was no explanation for the broken piece, for where it had come from and why it had been buried. None of Mother's plates had ever gone missing. Isabel knew this, and still she checked now. The set was as it had been left, a deck of plates, bowls, a little milk jug. In the middle of each one, three hares chasing one another in a circle. She took the piece with her on the train to Den Haag the next day, wrapped in brown paper. Hendrik's car was parked outside the restaurant when she arrived, and he was at the wheel, windows down, smoking, rubbing a thumb into his eye, looking like he was having a conversation with himself over something. A disagreement. His hair was longer than she liked it. She bent down and said, "Hello?" And he startled, knocked his elbow and said, "Jesus Christ, Isa!" She got in the car next to him, and kept her purse in her lap. He sighed out smoke and leaned over, kissed her three times, one on each cheek and one more for good measure. "You're early," she said. He said,
"That's a nice hat."
She touched it. "Yes." She'd worried over it, leaving the house. It was bigger than what she usually wore. It had a bright green ribbon.
In the sweltering peak of summer, Isabel's paranoia gives way to something entirely new, leading to a discovery that unravels all Isabel has ever known. The war might not be well and truly over after all, and neither Eva nor the house in which they live are what they seem.
"How are you then?"
"Oh, you know."
He ashed his cigarette out the window, leaned back.
"Sebastian's been talking about going home."
Isabel touched her hat once more, her nape. She pushed a bobby pin further into place. Hendrik had called recently to tell her as much. Sebastian's mother's health taking a turn for the worse. Sebastian wanting to visit her. Sebastian wanting Hendrik to come with him. Isabel had not known what to say of it, and so she said nothing. And so she ignored the information and instead updated him about the state of the garden, about Nielke, the maid, and how she might be stealing things, about Johan's disruptive visits that left her nonplussed, and about a recent car bill. Hendrik hung up quickly after that.
I think I will have to go with him,
he continued, not looking at her.
I can't let him go alone. I can't.
I found this, she interrupted, and took the wrapped package from her purse, opened it for him, still in her palm. Buried in the garden, under one of the gourds. He considered her for a moment, confused. Then, with a quick blink, a breath, took the piece and inspected it, turned it over.
One of Mother's plates?
It is, isn't it?
All right,
he said cautiously, and gave it back. On the other side of the street, a couple argued while they walked. The woman tried to hush the conversation. The man only raised his voice in response. Isabel continued on a held breath. I think Nielke...
Isabel...
Hendrik turned to face her now, cigarette still in hand, the space between them clouded with smoke.
There's not going to be any maids left in the province if you keep on firing all of them with some imaginary ideas of...
Imaginary? I have been stolen from. They have...
Once, he said. That happened once. And she was so young, Isa. Come on. Haven't you been young?
The audio version of The Safe Keep by Yael van der Woeden is read by Saskia Marleveld and Stinter Nielsen and is available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Orbital is written by Samantha Harvey, and in it, six astronauts rotate in the ISS. They are there to do vital work, but slowly they begin to wonder, what is life without Earth? What is Earth without humanity? The Booker Prize Foundation asked Samantha to describe her book in six words or less.
Six humans orbit our glorious planet.
A team of astronauts in the International Space Station collect meteorological data, conduct scientific experiments, and test the limits of the human body. But mostly, they observe.
Rotating about the Earth in their spacecraft, they are so together and so alone that even their thoughts, their internal mythologies, at times convene. Sometimes they dream the same dreams of fractals and blue spheres and familiar faces engulfed in dark, and of the bright, energetic black of space that slams their senses. Raw space is a panther, feral and primal. They dream it stalking through their quarters. They hang in their sleeping bags. A handspan away beyond the skin of metal, the universe unfolds in simple eternities. Their sleep begins to thin, and some distant earthly morning dawns, and their laptops flash, the first silent messages of a new day. The wide awake, always awake station vibrates with fans and filters. In the galley are the remnants of last night's dinner. Dirty forks secured to the table by magnets, and chopsticks wedged in a pouch on the wall. Four balloons are buoyed on the circulating air. Some foil bunting says, "Happy birthday." It was nobody's birthday, but it was a celebration, and it was all they had. There's a smear of chocolate on a pair of scissors and a small felt moon on a piece of string tied to the handles of the foldable table. Outside, the Earth reels away in a mass of moon glow, peeling backward as they forge towards its edgeless edge. The tufts of cloud across the Pacific brighten the nocturnal ocean to cobalt. Now there's Santiago on South America's approaching coast, in a cloud-hazed burn of gold. Unseen through the closed shutters, the trade winds blowing across the warm waters of the Western Pacific have worked up a storm, an engine of heat.
Together, they watch their silent blue planet, Together they watched their silent blue planet, circling it 16 times, spinning past continents and cycling through seasons, taking in glaciers and deserts, the peaks of mountains and the swells of oceans. Endless shows of spectacular beauty, witnessed in a single day.
The winds take the warmth out of the ocean, where it gathers, as clouds which thicken and curdle and begin to spin in vertical stacks that have formed a typhoon. As the typhoon moves west towards southern Asia, their craft tracks east, eastward and down towards Patagonia, where the lurch of a far-off aura domes the horizon in neon. The Milky Way is a smoking trail of gunpowder shot through a satin sky. On board the craft, it's Tuesday morning, 4:15, the beginning of October. Out there, it's Argentina, it's the South Atlantic, it's Cape Town, it's Zimbabwe. Over its right shoulder, the planet whispers morning, a slender molten breach of light. They slip through the time zones in silence.
Although separated from the world, they cannot escape its constant pull. News reaches them of the death of a mother, and with it comes thoughts of returning home. They look on as a typhoon gathers over an island and people they love, in awe of its magnificence and fearful of its destruction. The fragility of human life fills their conversations, their fears, their desires. So far from the Earth, yet they have never felt more part of it or protective of it.
They have each at some point been shot into the sky on a kerosene bomb, and then through the atmosphere in a burning capsule with the equivalent weight of two black bears upon them. They have each steeled their rib cages against the force until they felt the bears retreat, one after the other, and the sky become space, and gravity diminish, and their hair stand on end. Six of them, in a great H of metal hanging above the Earth, they turn head on heel, four astronauts, American, Japanese, British, Italian, and two cosmonauts, Russian. Two women, four men, one space station made up of 17 connecting modules. 17,500 miles an hour. They are the latest six of many. Nothing unusual about this anymore. Routine astronauts in Earth's backyard. Earth's fabulous and improbable backyard. Turning head on heel in the slow drift of their hurtle. Head on hip. On hand, on heel, turning and turning with the days. The days rush. They will each be here for 9 months or so. 9 months of this weightless drifting. 9 months of this swollen head. 9 months of this sardine living. 9 months of this earthward gaping. Then back to the patient planet below. Some alien civilization might look on and ask, what are they doing here? Why do they go nowhere but round and round? The Earth is the answer to every question. The Earth is the face of an exalted lover. They watch it sleep and wake and become lost in its habits. The Earth is a mother waiting for her children to return, full of stories and rapture and longing. Their bones are a little less dense, their limbs a little thinner, eyes filled with sights that are difficult to tell.
Orbital by Samantha Harvey is read by Sarah Nowdy and available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille. Also in the RNIB library is this, In Creation Lake by Rachel Kushner. A woman is caught in the crossfire between the past and the future in this part spy novel, part profound treatise on human history. The Booker Prize Foundation asked Rachel to describe her book in 6 words or less.
It's a tough assignment. Amoral woman makes trouble in France.
A slightly longer description would be that Sadie has met her love, Lucien, a young and well-born Parisian, by cold bump, making him believe the encounter was accidental. Like everyone Sadie targets, Lucien is useful to her and used by her. But is she the seductress and puppet master she thinks she is? The audio version of Creation Lake is read by the author, Rachel Kushner.
Neanderthals were prone to depression, he said. He said they were prone to addiction, too, and especially smoking. Although it was likely, he said, that these noble and mysterious talls, as he sometimes referred to the Neanderthals, extracted nicotine from the tobacco plant by a cruder method, such as by chewing its leaves, before that critical point of inflection in the history of the world, when the first man touched the first tobacco leaf to the first fire. Reading this part of Bruno's email, scanning from man to touch to leaf to fire, I pictured a 1950s greaser in a white t-shirt and a black leather jacket as he touches a lit match to the tip of his Camel cigarette and inhales. The greaser leans against a wall, because that is what greasers do. They lean and loiter, and then he exhales.
Sadie operates by strategy and dissimulation, based on what her contacts, shadowy figures in business and government, instruct. First, these contacts want her to incite provocation. Then they want more.
Bruno Lacombe told Pascal, in these emails I was secretly reading, that the Neanderthals had very large brains, or at least their skulls were very large, and we can safely infer that their skulls were likely filled, Bruno said, with brains. He talked about the impressive size of a tall's brain case, using modern metaphors, comparing them to motorcycle engines, which were also measured, he noted, for their displacement. Of all the human-like species who stood upon 2 feet, who roamed the earth for the last 1 million years, Bruno said that the Neanderthal's brain case was way out in front, at a whopping 1,800 cubic centimeters. I pictured a king of the road, way out in front. I saw his leather vest, his big gut, legs extended, engineer's boots resting on roomy and chromed forward-mounted foot pegs. His chopper is fitted with ape hangers that he can barely reach, and which he pretends are not making his arms tired, are not causing terrible shooting pains to his lumbar region. We know from their skulls, Bruno said, that Neanderthals had enormous faces. I pictured Joan Crawford, that scale of face, dramatic, brutal, compelling. And thereafter, in the Natural History Museum in my mind, the one I was creating as I read Bruno's emails, its dioramas populated by figures in loincloths with yellow teeth and matted hair, all these ancient people Bruno described, the men, too, they all had Joan Crawford's face. They had her fair skin and her flaming red hair. A propensity for red hair, Bruno said, had been identified as a genetic trait of the tall, as scientific advancements in gene mapping were made. And beyond such work, such proof, Bruno said, we might employ our natural intuition to suppose that, like typical redheads, the Neanderthals' emotions were strong and acute, spanning the heights and depths.
In this region of centuries-old farms and ancient caves, Sadie becomes entranced by a mysterious figure named Bruno Lacombe, a mentor to the young activist who communicates only by email. Bruno believes that the path to emancipation from what ails modern life is not revolt, but a return to the ancient past.
A few more things, Bruno wrote to Pascal, that we now know about Neanderthals. They were good at math. They did not enjoy crowds. They had strong stomachs and were not especially prone to ulcers, but their diet of constant barbecue did its damage, as it would to anyone's gut. They were extra vulnerable to tooth decay and gum disease, and they had overdeveloped jaws, wonderfully capable of chewing gristle and cartilage, but inefficient for softer fare, a jaw that was overkill. Bruno described the jaw of the Neanderthal as a feature of pathos for its overdevelopment, the burden of a square jaw. He talked about sunk costs as if the body were a capital investment, a fixed investment, the parts of the body like machines bolted to a factory floor, equipment that had been purchased and could not be resold. The Neanderthal jaw was a sunk cost. Still, the tall's heavy bones and sturdy, heat-conserving build were to be admired, Bruno said, especially compared to the breadstick limbs of modern man, Homo sapiens sapiens. Bruno did not say breadstick, but since I was translating, as he was writing these emails in French, I drew from the full breadth of English, a wildly superior language, and my native tongue. The Talls survived cold very well, he said, if not the eons, or so the story about them goes, a story that we must complicate, he said, if we are to know the truth about the ancient past, if we are to glimpse the truth about this world now and how to live in it, how to occupy the present, and where to go tomorrow. My own tomorrow was thoroughly planned out. I would be meeting Pascal Balmy, leader of Le Moulin, to whom these emails from Bruno Lacombe were written. And I didn't need the Neanderthal's help on where to go. Pascal Balmy said to go to the Café de la Route on the main square in the little village of Vendôme at 1 p.m., and that was where I would be.
Creation Lake, written and read by Rachel Kushner, is available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. On today's Read On, we are listening to the six books on the Booker Prize shortlist ahead of the winner's announcement on Tuesday. And next up is James by Percival Everett, a profound meditation on identity, belonging and sacrifices we make to protect the ones we love, which reimagines the adventures of Huckleberry Finn. The Booker Prize Foundation asked Percival Everett to describe his book in six words or less.
A conversation with Mark Twain.
The Mississippi River, 1861. When the enslaved Jim overhears that he is about to be sold to a new owner in New Orleans and separated from his wife and daughter forever, he decides to hide on nearby Jackson's Island until he can formulate a plan. The audio version of James by Percival Everett is read by Dominic Hoffman.
Those little bees were hiding out there in the tall grass. The moon was not quite full, but bright, and it was behind them, so I could see them as plain as day, though it was deep night. Lightning bugs flashed against the black canvas. I waited at Miss Watson's kitchen door, rocked a loose stepboard with my foot, knew she was going to tell me to fix it tomorrow. I was waiting there for her to give me a pan of cornbread that she had made with my Sadie's recipe. Waiting is a big part of a slave's life. Waiting and waiting to wait some more. Waiting for demands. Waiting for food. Waiting for the ends of days. Waiting for the just and deserved Christian reward at the end of it all. Those white boys, Huck and Tom, watched me. They were always playing some kind of pretending game where I was either a villain or prey, but certainly their toy. They hopped about out there with the chiggers, mosquitoes, and other biting bugs, but never made any progress toward me. It always pays to give white folks what they want, so I stepped into the yard and called out into the night. Who that there, in the dark, like that? They rustled clumsily about, giggled. Those boys couldn't sneak up on a blind and deaf man while a band was playing. I would rather have been wasting time counting lightning bugs than bothering with them. I guess I just gonna set these old bones down on this here porch and watch out for that noise again. Maybe there'll be some old demon or witch out there. I'm gonna stay right here where it'd be safe.
Meanwhile, Huck Finn has faked his own death to escape his violent father, who has recently returned to town. Thus begins a dangerous and transcendent journey by raft along the Mississippi River towards the elusive promise of free states and beyond.
The boys sneaked awkwardly, crawled knees over fists, and none too quietly across the complaining boards of the porch and inside through the Dutch door of Miss Watson's kitchen. I heard them in there rifling about, opening cabinet doors and drawers. I kept my eyes closed and ignored a mosquito that landed on my arm. "Here we go," Tom said. "I'm gonna just take three." "You can't just take an old lady's candles," Huck said. "That's stealing. What if they blame Jim for that?" "Here, I'll leave her this here nickel. That's more than enough. They won't expect no slave. Where's slave gonna get a nickel? Now let's get out of here before she shows up." The boys stepped out onto the porch. I don't imagine that they were hardly aware of all the noise they made. "You should have left a note, too," Huck said. "No need for all that," Tom said. "Nickel's plenty." I could feel the boys' eyes turn to me. I remained still. "What you doing?" Huck asked. "I'm gonna play a little joke on old Jim. You're gonna wake him up is what you're gonna do. Hush up." Tom stepped behind me and grabbed my hat brim and my ears. "Tom," Huck complained. "Shh." Tom lifted my hat off my head. "I'm just gonna hang this old hat on this old nail." "What's that supposed to do?" Huck asked. "When he wakes up, he's gonna think a witch done it. I just wish we could be round to see it." "Okay, it be on the nail. Now let's get," Huck said. Someone stirred inside the house, and the boys took off running, turned the corner in a full gallop, and kicked up dust. I could hear their footfalls fade.
As James and Huck begin to navigate the treacherous waters, each bend in the river holds the promise of both salvation and demise. With rumours of a brewing war, James must face the burden he carries, the family he is desperate to protect, and the constant lie he must love. And together, the unlikely pair must face the most dangerous odyssey of them all.
Now someone was in the kitchen at the door. "Jim?" It was Miss Watson. "Yes'm." "Was you asleep?" "No, ma'am. I isn't my tired, but I ain't been asleep." "Was you in my kitchen?" "No, ma'am." "Was anybody in my kitchen?" "Not that I seen, ma'am." That was quite actually true, as my eyes had been closed the whole time. "I ain't seen nobody in your kitchen." "Well, here's that cornbread. You can tell Sadie that I like her recipe. I made a couple of changes, you know, to refine it." "Yes'm. I sure tell her." "You seen Huck about?" she asked. "I seen him earlier." "How long ago?" "A spell," I said. "Jim, I'm going to ask you a question now. Have you been in Judge Thatcher's library room?" "In his what?" "His library. You mean that room with all them books?" "Yes." "No, missums. I seen them books, but I ain't been in the room." "Why for you be asking me that?" "Oh, he found some book off the shelves." I laughed. "What I gonna do with a book?" She laughed too. The cornbread was wrapped in a thin towel, and I had to keep shifting hands because it was hot. I considered having a taste because I was hungry, but I wanted Sadie and Elizabeth to have the first bites. When I stepped through the door, Lizzie ran to me, sniffing the air like a hound. "What's that I smell?" she asked. "I imagine that would be this cornbread," I said. "Miss Watson used your mama's special recipe, and it certainly does smell good. She did inform me that she made a couple of alterations. Sadie came to me and gave me a kiss on the mouth. She stroked my face. She was soft and her lips were soft, but her hands were as rough as mine from work in the fields, though still gentle. I'll be sure to take this towel back to her tomorrow. White folks always remember things like that. I swear, I believe they set aside time every day to count towels and spoons and cups and such. That's the honest truth. Remember that time I forgot to put that rake back in the shed? Sadie had the cornbread on the block, a stump, really, that served as our table. She sliced into it. She handed portions to Lizzie and me. I took a bite, and so did Lizzie. We looked at each other. But it smells so good, the child said. Sadie shaved off a sliver and put it in her mouth. I swear that woman has a talent for not cooking.
Dominic Hoffman, reading from James by Percival Everett. Available from RNIB Talking Books. And here's our next Booker shortlist, the title available in audio and braille from RNIB. In Charlotte Wood's book, Stoneyard Devotional, the past comes knocking in this fearless exploration of forgiveness, grief, and female friendship. Here's author Charlotte Wood's six-word description from the Booker Prize Foundation.
Undercurrents, spaciousness, contemplation, visitation, disturbances, and atonement.
A woman abandons her city life and marriage to return to the place where she grew up, finding solace in a small religious community hidden away on the stark plains of the Monaro. She does not believe in God, doesn't know what prayer is, and finds herself living this strange, reclusive life, almost by accident. Stoneyard Devotional is read by Ilsa Piper.
Arrive, finally, at about 3. The place has the feel of a 1970s health resort or eco-commune, but is not welcoming. Signs on fences or stuck on little posts by driveways. No entry. No parking. A place of industry, not recreation. I park in a nondescript spot near a fence and sit in the quiet car. On the way here, I stopped in the town and visited my parents' graves for the first time in 35 years. It took some time for me to find them in what is called the Lawn Cemetery, the newer part, fenced off, why, from the original town graveyard, with its crooked rows of tilting white headstones and crosses. That old part is overlooked by enormous black pine trees. Ravens and cockatoos scream from their high branches. The Lawn Cemetery, by contrast, is a dull, flat expanse, filled with gently curved rows of low, ugly headstones of identical dimensions. Neater, I suppose. But why should a cemetery be neat? There is no lawn, just dusty dead grass. To find my parents, I had to recall the cold, unsheltered feeling I had, physically, I mean, at each of their funerals. There had been the sensation of too much space around me there, at the place where my father, then later my mother, were sent into their adjacent shafts of opened earth. It seemed callous to me back then to lower a person into a hole in the ground using ropes and cords instead of arms. But walking around the cemetery now, remembering that sensation helped me find the spot again. I stood before my mother's and father's gravestones, two machine-cut and polished pieces of stone.
As she gradually adjusts to the rhythms of monastic life, she ruminates on her childhood in the nearby town. She finds herself turning again and again to thoughts of her mother, whose early death she can't forget.
The colour and design of the stones and the words on them seemed to bear no trace of either of my parents, though I must have decided on, approved of them. Someone had pushed some ugly plastic flowers into the small metal grate beside the headstones. Perhaps there are volunteers who go around leaving fake flowers at unvisited graves. Who else would want to mark my parents' burial place after all this time? The plastic of the flowers had turned grey, every part of them, though they must have once been luridly coloured, like those I could see sticking up from the little metal vases at other headstones. Ragged, synthetic petals in puce and maroon and white, with dark green stems, angled here and there with artificial nodules and leaves. I stood on the grass and looked at the ugly flowers, then at my parents' names carved into each slab in front of me. And I realized, your bones are here, beneath my feet. I squatted then, those few feet of earth between their bodies and mine, and I kissed my fingers and pressed them to the crackly grass.
This quiet interrupts this secluded life with three visitations. First comes a terrible mouse plague. Second is the return of the skeletal remains of a sister who disappeared decades before. And finally, a troubling visitor plunges the narrator further back into her past.
Walking back to the car, I remembered something else. A phone call, many months after my mother's death. A man's voice quietly telling me her headstone was ready. I recall standing by the laundry door with the phone in my hand, my outsides unaltered, but everything within me plummeting, like a sandbank collapsing inside me. Near the end of the drive, the sky darkened, turned drizzly. The road coiled up a steep hill, entering a tunnel of thick bush. My car struggled on the wet bitumen. And then, on the other side, it opened out into these endless, shallow, angular plains, bare as rubbed suede. Place names I thought I'd forgotten returned to me one by one. Chocola, Royala, Breadbow, Bunyan. Jarangle, Babundra, Kelton Plain, Rocky Plain, Dry Plain. Like beads on a rosary. Like naming the bones of my own body.
Ailes the Piper, reading from Stoneyard Devotional by Charlotte Wood. Available from R&IB Talking Books in both audio and braille.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on R&IB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, let's get some book recommendations from the winner of the Booker Prize last year, Paul Lynch. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
When I was about seven or eight, my teacher at school handed me The Prisoner of Zenda. And I'm sure it was an abridged version. It must have been abridged because I would have been too young to read it in full. But it just grabbed me and sucked me in. And that was the start of the madness. And, you know, I actually want to mention as the key thing really was the Hardy Boys. And I know you probably don't expect me to say that, but the Hardy Boys, I mean, I was about nine, my grandparents traveled from Limerick to where I lived in Donegal, and they gave me a suitcase of books, and it was a suitcase of 1960s hardback editions of the Hardy Boys that my uncle, who was also a writer, had bought when he was a kid. And the story went that he, without telling his parents, stopped taking the bus to school, and he kept the money from the bus, and he saved it up, and he would buy himself a new Hardy Boy book every 2 weeks or so. So I just got into the Hardy Boys books to the extent that, you know, I read literally every single one then numbered, which was, I think, around 84, 85 of them. And there was only one that I couldn't get called The House on the Cliff. And it was in Donegal, rural Donegal, 1980s, pre-internet, you know, things just couldn't be got then. And, but so that I was obsessed with the Hardy Boys. And from then I moved on to, I think I was about 11, I started reading Jack Egan's thrillers.
Frank and Joe Hardy clutched the grips of their motorcycles and stared in horror at the oncoming car. It was careening from side to side on the narrow road. He'll hit us. We'd better climb this hillside and fast, Frank exclaimed as the boys brought their motorcycles to a screeching halt and leaped off. On the double, Joe cried out as they started up the steep embankment. To their amazement, the reckless driver suddenly pulled his car hard to the right and turned into a side road on two wheels. The boys expected the car to turn over, but it held the dusty ground and sped off out of sight. Wow, said Joe. Let's get away from here before the crazy guy comes back. That's a dead-end road, you know. The boys scrambled back onto their motorcycles and gunned them a bit to get past the intersecting road in a hurry. They rode in silence for a while, gazing at the scene ahead. On their right, an embankment of tumbled rocks and boulders sloped steeply to the water below. From the opposite side rose a jagged cliff. The little-traveled road was winding and just wide enough for two cars to pass. "Boy, I'd hate to fall off the edge of this road," Frank remarked. "It's a 100-foot drop." "That's right," Joe agreed. "We'd sure be smashed to bits before we ever got to the bottom." Then he smiled. "Watch your step, Frank, or Dad's papers won't get delivered."
Available from R&IB Talking Books, The Best of the Hardy Boys by Franklin Dixon is narrated by Ian Nauer, and The Prisoner of Zenda by Anthony Hope is available as narrated by George Hagen. Is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
I love Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo, a Mexican master novelist. And it's a book that I've read it 6 or 7 times, and it's like a great tree that you can't get your arms around. That's the only way I can describe it. And yet it's such a slim book. It's a novella. It's set in this small mythical town in Mexico where a man returns to discover that the overlord, so to speak, of the area has just brought complete destruction upon the place. And it's a book that creates its own rules, its own laws, almost its own physics, because the dead are there with the living, and the tenses change, and the language changes. It is a key precursor to magical realism. It's one of the sort of Rosetta Stones to magical realism. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez loved the book so much that he actually learned it off by heart. And it's just a book that I just keep going back to, you know. I just love it so much.
Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo is available in audio, but only in Spanish, as narrated by Mauricio Carrera. There is an English translation available on YouTube. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but some you've read recently, fresh in the mind, and you'd like to recommend.
I was in my library recently, and I saw a book by Elsa Morante, a great Italian novelist. And I have my first Italian translator has said to me a number of times, you really need to read Elsa Morante's history. And I went looking for it and I couldn't find it to have, but this book was not that one. It was called Arturo's Island, and it had been published quite recently, and it was translated by Anna Goldstein, who is the translator of Elena Ferrante. And I mean, in Italy, Morante is a sort of a canonical Italian novelist, but in English, she just never truly sort of made it across. And I don't understand why, because Arturo's Island is a book worthy of being a world classic. It's just an extraordinary, unique book full of mystery and magic and a sense of the 19th century novel sort of shaping it a little bit. It's about a boy on this island called Procida off Napoli. And his mother is dead, and his father, who's this sort of scamp, has returned to the island with a very young wife, and Arturo falls in love with the young wife. And it's a very, very unique book. It's a very deep book. If you know, it has oceanic depths and mysteries in it, and that impressed me very much.
Around the port, the streets are all sunless alleys, lined with plain centuries-old houses, which, although painted in beautiful pink or grayish shell colors, look severe and melancholy. On the sills of the small windows, which are almost as narrow as loopholes, you sometimes see a carnation growing in a tin can, or a little cage that seems fit for a cricket, but holds a captured turtle dove. The shops are as deep and dark as brigands' dens. In the cafe at the port, there's a coal stove on which the owner boils Turkish coffee, in a deep blue enameled coffee pot. She's been a widow for many years, and always wears the black of mourning, the black shawl, the black earrings. A photograph of the deceased, on the wall beside the cash register, is festooned with dusty leaves. The innkeeper in his tavern, which is opposite the monument of Christ the Fisherman, is raising an owl, chained to a plank high up against the wall. The owl has delicate black and gray feathers, an elegant tuft on his head, blue eyelids, and big eyes of a red-gold color, circled with black. He always has a bleeding wing, because he constantly pecks at it with his beak. If you stretch out a hand to give him a little tickle on the chest, he bends his small head towards you, with an expression of wonder. When evening descends, he starts to struggle, tries to take off, and falls back, and sometimes ends up hanging head down, flapping on his chain.
Arturo's Island by Elsa Morante, translated by Anne Goldstein and narrated by PJ Ochan, is available commercially. And once again, Paul Lynch, thank you so much.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for having me.
The winner of the Booker will be announced on Tuesday, the 12th of October, with all of the books now available from RNIB Talking Books in both audio and braille. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.